Good afternoon. First of all, I would like to congratulate Ramon with his almost 70 years. Many congratulations, Ramon. I remember it is almost 15 years ago that we sent one of our younger students, Greg Boone, to Girona. And ever since then, there has been intensive contacts between your group and ours. So it's a pleasure to thank you for all that. Today we will not talk about similarity, which has been a common point of interest, but about conceptual density functional theory. And my co-authors here are Nick Sablon and Tim Fierveri, who are PhD students in our group. Pablo Hecke, who has done a postdoc in our group, Paul Ayers, present in the audience, with whom we work already a long time together on these points, and Frank McGough, who is the co-director of the group. I will talk about a short introduction about conceptual density functional theory, or if you want, chemical concepts from DFT, mainly on the linear response function, how to get it and what can we do with it, and if time permits, we go on with some higher order derivatives. Now, a few words as an introduction, chemical concepts from DFT. Of course, it's needless to say in front of this audience that everything starts with the Hohenberg-Kohn theorems, that rho r is the basic variable, that rho r determines the number of electrons through normalization, and that the external potential V of r is determined within a trivial additive constant by the electron density. In other words, if you are given an electron density for a ground state, it is compatible with a single constellation of the nuclei, including their position and their charge. Now, this means that rho r determines the Hamiltonian and so the energy, and you can write this expression with a universal Hohenberg-Kohn functional. Applying then the variational principle, you come to this equation, which is the analog of the time-independent Schrödinger equation, and for our purpose this mu is very important. It's the Lagrangian multiplier, which appears because one asks at all time that density should be normalized. But you will see that in the conceptual or chemical DFT, if you want, this Lagrangian multiplier plays also a very important role. The practical implementation has been done, of course, through the Cohn-Sharm equations, giving a computational breakthrough, but that is not the essence of today's talk. The essence is, like I told you, conceptual DFT, and I always spend at least 15 seconds to explain that maybe the term has not been chosen properly by Parr, because, of course, it gives the idea that in other parts of the DRT there are no concepts, which is, of course, absolutely untrue. But he baptized it conceptual DFT, maybe chemical DFT would have been better. Here I try to define it. It's a branch of DFT aiming to give precision to often well-known but rather vaguely defined chemical concepts, such as electronegativity, chemical hardness, softness, to extend the extending descriptors and to use them either as such or within the concept of principles, and there are a few principles, electronegativity equalization principle, the hard and soft acids and bases principle, and the maximum hardness principle. And it all starts with Parr's landmark paper on the identification of this mu, remember, as the opposite of the electronegativity. And it is in fact casted in a perturbative approach to chemical reactivity, realizing that when you perturb an atomic or molecular system, you perturb it either in its number of electrons or in the external potential or in both. And so you can write at first order this equation, and precisely this derivative has been identified as this Lagrangian multiplier mu. And this derivative is nothing else than the basic quantity of DFT, the electron density function. So this is the basic equation up to first order in this perturbative approach to chemical reactivity. Of course you can go on, and yesterday Christophe Morel already showed this kind of picture, in which you go on to the second derivatives. Here you got the second derivative of E with respect to N, you got the hardness. Here you got a mixed derivative, which is the way in which the electron density at each point responds to a perturbation in the total number of electrons, this is the Fukui function. And then you got this linear response function, which is the second functional derivative of the energy with respect to the external potential. Now, there are also combined descriptors. I will not read them today, but one of the most famous one is the electrophilicity introduced by Parr and later on exploited, among others, by Chatterer. Meanwhile, there are a lot of reviews on this topic, and you can read if you are interested. Now, if you've got this whole bunch of reactivity descriptors, or if you want response functions, because they indicate how the system will respond when it is perturbed, you can put some historical hierarchy in it. It started essentially with mu, the first derivative, in the electronegativity equalization principle already in the 1950s by Sanderson. Later, Wilfried Mortier from Leuven did a lot of work on it. Then you introduced, or became popular, the hardness and the softness with the work by Pearson and also by Parr. For example, within the context of the HSCB principle, hard acids prefer to react with hard bases, soft acids with soft bases. And then you see here the appearance of the Fukui function, which you can also use to make a local analog of the softness, namely the local softness introduced by Parr and Whitehouse Yang, who are present in the audience. Now, there is one second order derivative remaining, which is this linear response function, and there are the third order derivatives remaining. The point is, are they interesting, or should they be interesting? What about this second order derivative? You see, at first it's a rather intricate thing. It indicates how the density at a given point reacts when you perturb it, when the system, in its external potential at another point, at constant number of electrons. I think you see that is probably computationally demanding, and even if you succeed in calculating this thing, it is not easy to get some chemical interpretation from it. You've got a six-dimensional curve. So condensation up to atomic level probably is here at stake. This thing is probably of very fundamental importance. Why? Because it gives information about the influence of the propagation of a perturbation due to an external potential on the electron density at other points in the system. Now, there has already been fundamental work on this linear response function. There is the famous Berkowitz-Parr relationship relating this quantity with the so-called softness kernel, which is the same derivative with a minus sign, but important, taken at constant electronic chemical potential. This quantity is a fundamental quantity. If you integrate, you find the local softness. If you integrate once more, you find the total softness. If you invert, you find the hardness kernel, and from the hardness kernel, you find a lot of other information. So it's a fundamental carrier of information, and you see these two are related. What about the third order derivatives? Well, there has been some numerical work already on the third order derivative of the energy with respect to N, the so-called hyperhardness, and it is known to be small. My personal opinion is that it will not play a very important role in the future anymore. On the other hand, you could think of this kind of derivative, which is at least awkward to term. It's the derivative of this response function, again, with respect to an external potential. Probably, and there are already strong indications, as Christophe Morel has shown us, there are interesting things in the, what I call the mixed 2 plus 1 derivative, this one, which is nothing else than the second derivative of the density with respect to the number of electrons, or if you want, the functional derivative of the hardness with respect to the external potential. It has been termed a dual descriptor, and there are already a number of applications. I also will try to cover some of them in the final part. And then there is this third derivative, which is the derivative of the linear response function with respect to the number of electrons. It is, as far as we know, relatively or unexplored, but it might play a role in describing changes in polarizability upon ionization or electron attachment. Okay, knowing that, the talk will essentially cover the calculation of this quantity and some examples of the computation and use of the dual descriptor. What about this linear response function? In the literature by Sidney, Cohen, Polliers and others, there are already some formal discussions about this quantity, and the most important mathematical properties have been summarized beautifully by Leo and Ayers. The question now is how to get to some numerical values. And if you dig in the very old chemical literature, going back to Hückel, you find in fact that in Hückel theory there is something like that, which is dQd alpha, alpha here being the Hückel parameter alpha, and it is in fact termed at that time the mutual atom-atom polarizability. Of course it's restricted to pi electron system, but this has been a starting fact in the literature. There has been some work by Bartelant and Wang in the context of electronegativity equalization, but as far as we know, there is no direct, generally applicable, and nearly exact approach available. I will show two ways that we think we can go through this question. The first one is an orbital-based approach. Take a single Slater determinant, apply second-order perturbation theory. We take a simple case of a closed shell, spin-restricted, frozen core. We take this approximation in second-order perturbation theory, and we arrive at this equation, which has been discussed by Paul in Faraday discussions. So you got here your occupied orbitals, unoccupied orbitals, and your orbital energies. In principle, you got these quantities, but the question is, of course, how do we visualize or interpret the six-dimensional kernel? Well, thanks to a program which has been developed mainly by Mikhail Torrens-Surratt from Girona during his postdoc in our lab, we now can integrate in atomic volumes this quantity and so end up with a kind of, or with an atom-condensed linear response matrix. Now, here is an example of this linear response matrix for the molecule ethanol. What you see is that you've got large values along the diagonal, and just to give an idea, because you need a reference to discuss, these values for carbon and oxygen are substantially larger than in ethanol. The non-diagonal element, and this should be a plus sign here, is substantially larger again than in ethanol. And this is, of course, related to the higher polarizability of the carbon-oxygen double bond as compared to the carbon-oxygen single bond. For the rest, what you see is a decrease in values of the off-diagonal elements when the interatomic distances are increasing. Remarkably, when you compare these values with the very simple electronegativity equalization treatment, you find a very nice correlation coefficient. Now, this first experience gave us confidence in the possibilities of exploration of the transmission of various effects, electronic effects, in molecules in organic chemistry, the well-known cases of inductive and mesomeric effects. And this is what I will discuss now briefly. What we looked at is the transmission of a perturbation through a carbon chain. And we looked at two cases, the saturated case and an unsaturated case, with R being the traditional functional groups, OH, NH2, CN, and an aldehyde group. In blue, you see the saturated case, and you see here the response function on a given, or between, a given carbon atom and the oxygen atom in the case of hexanol, for example. What you see is that you got a decrease in this response going to zero after four or five bonds. So you see the density response of the carbon atoms on a heteroatom perturbation decreases monotonously with the distance. And you see here the same in the case of the amine. You can try an exponential fit, and it works quite well. You find something of this order. And this will come back in the later discussion, the fact that you can put an exponential curve for representing this blue curve. On the other hand, you see that for the unsaturated systems, you got a behavior which is totally different. You see that there are places where you got a large response, atoms 2, 4, 6, 2, 4, 6. And of course, this is reminiscent of the mesomeric active atoms in that system. On the other hand, you see that it is decreasing still. But this is, of course, a combination, as one can foresee, of the inductive and the mesomeric effect. So on the next slide, you see in detail the mesomeric forms being written, and you see that everything is okay. You see the maxima at atoms 2, 4, 6, the mesomeric active atoms, and the minima at 1, 3, 5, the mesomeric passive atoms. Here you see the same with mesomeric acceptors, CHO and CN, and the story is identical. You see in the case of the saturated system, you see an exponential decrease in the blue curve, and in the unsaturated system, you see maxima at 2, 4, 6, but decreasing because of the superposition of the inductive effect, and here you see the same effect. Okay, so this gave us courage to have confidence in what this response function gives us as an answer. It seems indeed that as chemists we can get an answer on how is a certain atom responding on a perturbation on another atom. Now, this incited us to think a little bit about the connection of these results with a, as far as I'm concerned, intriguing series of papers by Cohn about the nearsightedness of electronic matter. There has been a short paper in PRL in 96 and a much more extended paper in PNAS in 2005. To summarize things, what Cohn says is that for systems, very many electrons, at constant electronic chemical potential, the change in density at a point R0 induced by a perturbation at a point R prime, with R prime outside the radius R, around R0, will always be smaller than the maximum magnitude delta R tilde. In fact, what he says then is that the maximum response of the electron density will decay monotonously as a function of R. As far as I know, he has never worked it out for what I call a real atom or a real molecule, but the examples he gives are indicating that this indeed probably will happen. Now, what you see is that we are talking here, or Cohn is talking, about a response of a density to a perturbation in the external potential. So this means that in fact he's talking about this quantity, and this quantity is this famous softness kernel. And as far as we know, on real atoms or molecules, there are no applications yet at this moment. Now, Paul has indicated that the softness kernel is nearsighted. The linear response kernel isn't. You see here the two appearing in the famous Berkowitz-Pahn relationship, and here you see a far-sighted contribution to chi. Now, let us suppose for a moment that the electron transfer is not very important. You can think of the pure inductive effect. And so let us for a moment say that we can neglect this term. Then you see that chi may behave as S. Now, it has been indicated by Cohn that this S should decline exponentially as R and R prime get further apart, and this is precisely the exponential decay we observed for the inductive effect in the systems that we have been discussing. So we think that here a first indication of numerical evidence in real atoms or molecules is given about these aspects of nearsightedness. Just to mention that very recently we did work on substituted benzenes and cyclohexanes. I will not read them in too many details, but what you see here in green and in yellow are cyclohexene and cyclohexanol, and you see the response at atom 2 or 3 or 4 when a perturbation is given or brought in at atom 1. And you see again here this exponential decrease, and of course then an exponential increase because your ring is closed. And if you do that in the case of benzene in blue and phenol in red, you see again that there are atoms where this decrease is no longer existing, but you got an increase at the mesomerically active atoms. We obtain similar results for other systems. I will not go into many details, but here, for example, you see the case of benzaldehyde and phenol, very similar, and here phenol and toluene. In the last case, toluene, you see again that only the inductive effect is at work, whereas in phenol, you got the mesomeric effect being most important. So, that is what I wanted to say about the first way that we can go, or we can try to get to this linear response function. But there is another way that we are exploring, and this is the direct evaluation of the second order functional derivative. We are working in this field already a few years because we already tried to work in this field for evaluation of the Fukui function and the dual descriptor, which are respectively the first functional derivative of mu with respect to v and of eta, the hardness with respect to v. Why did we do that? Because we wanted to circumvent, like I told you, this work we've been doing already some time, because we want to avoid this differentiation with respect to the number of electrons, and through Maxwell relations you can turn these quantities into quantities where you got a differentiation with respect to the external potential. Now, what was the idea? The idea was to evaluate this functional derivative numerically by putting perturbations on a series of points, and then if you work in a linear response regime, you delete this term, and you expand this quantity in a basis set, you end up with this kind of series of equations, and with the least squares fitting, you finally obtain these expansion coefficients. The perturbations are simply point charges, you can take them positive or negative, and the expansion functions are S or P-type Gaussian orbitals with exponents doubled, because we are talking about densities. Now here you see an example of the Fukui function F plus for formaldehyde obtained with this technique. So not with the DDN, but with the DDV. And what you see here is your carbon. You see that you got the regions, or the region, of a nucleophilic attack coming perfectly. And you see also that the angle that was discussed yesterday already is beautifully appearing. On the other hand, one of our favorites, the pyrocyanide ion, where you got the local softness, and here is the sulfur atom, and you see here the larger contours in that region. So first order seems to work. What about now about second order? In fact, it is similar, but a little bit more work. You can again expand this, and you end up with the perturbations, expansion, and condensation to a second way in obtaining the linear response function. These are now very recent results obtained by Nick Sablon in the last part of his thesis. This is the result, or are the results, for formaldehyde with the previous method, the present method. The results are not identical, which was not to be expected, but what is very hopeful is that you see the correlation here between the new and the old results, with a slope which is nearly 1 and with a correlation coefficient which is very high. So we are now writing down the results for some small molecules and hope to get first to some conclusions. These are the conclusions as far as the discussion of the linear response function is concerned. It comes within reach of a general strategy. It is a tool by excellence to investigate how information on perturbations is propagated through the system. Atom condensation is at stake. And it has been shown to account for a difference in fall-off of the behavior of inductive and mesomeric effects. And you see there is a connection with the concept of nearsightedness. And finally, the way to the softness kernel has almost, not completely, has almost been paved. So with the time left, I will spend a few minutes about the third order derivatives. And I will concentrate on one of these, a derivative of the type 2 plus 1, the dual descriptor. I will go quickly through this because this has been explained by Christophe Morel. Remember, it's the second derivative of rho with respect to n, and it gives you a one-shot picture of electrophilic regions and nucleophilic regions. Here, for example, you see also one of our favorite molecules, carbene, where you got in red an electrophilic region, which is this empty orbital, and in blue you got a nucleophilic region where you got the lone pair. Now, as discussed by Morel, one should look for regions that are overlapping, blue and red, and you can rationalize this. And what we try to do is, within this context, to rationalize or to retrieve the famous Woodward-Hoffman rules, which were based, as you know, on wave functions, and more specifically, on the phase of the wave functions, which is, of course, disappearing when you talk about densities. We also looked at these reactions in terms of another third order derivative, the hardness, initial hardness response, giving the way the hardness is responding to changes in distances or angles at the beginning of the reaction. Because the idea is when a transition state is hard, it is stabilized, and so the initial curvature or the initial change in hardness will give an indication whether you go to a high transition state or a lower transition state. Meanwhile, we covered all the types of Woodward-Hoffman type reactions. I will show you two examples. The first one, cycloadditions. Some of you may have seen this before. I simply consider the 4 plus 2 addition, butadiene and ethene. Here is the dual descriptor, and what you see here is that if you approach, or if the two molecules approach each other in a supra-supra way, you've got an overlap between red and blue, so you've got stabilizing interactions. If you take the 2 plus 2 case, you see that you've got repulsion, and that this repulsion can only be relieved if you work into a supra-antera fashion. And the similar results were obtained by the initial hardness response. To end, the fourth case, which are kilotropic reactions. In this case, the filled and vacant frontier orbitals for bonding to other atoms are on the same atom. For example, CO or singlet carbenes. And here you see the case of SO2, with here the HOMO, doubly occupied, and the LUMO. Just a reminder, the Woodward-Hoffman rules, they say that if you attack in a linear way, this means that if you got here your butadiene, then your SO2 attacks this way, you will have a disrotatory mode, and in the nonlinear case, when it attacks that way, you will have an inverted mode. Now, here you see the case of a linear attack, so here is the SO2 molecule. Here you see the initial hardness response. In red you see the disrotatory mode, which is at lower energy, and here in red you see in the hardness the disrotatory mode, which is at higher hardness. So this, it makes sense. It's confirmed in the 4n plus 2 case. What about a nonlinear case? I will skip that, but the results are completely inverted. And finally, I will go to the dual descriptor approach. Here, the blue regions are now in green. What you see here for the linear approach is that you see a number of stabilizing interactions, red and green, and here also. And what you see is that if you want to optimize the interactions, there should be a disrotatory movement so that these green parts are not coming too close to each other. And so again, you find here the Woodward-Hoffman rules again. And in the case of the nonlinear calotropic reactions, what you first see is that you've got a lot of destabilizing interactions. And as far as I know, this reaction experimentally has not been determined or detected in this mode, but if it happens, it will work in a conrotatory mode. So, I skip this, which explains the relationship between the two third order derivatives, and I think that this example shows you the importance of third order derivatives. And let me conclude in this way. I think for a long time chemistry has been working at first order. Electronegativity can be considered as a first order effect, Pauli. Then correction for hardness, softness, polarizability, the frontier remote theory, you obtain second order view. And now you see that third order comes into play. I'm convinced that not all third order effects will be important, but probably some of these third order effects may contain important chemical information. So finally, I want to thank my co-authors again. I also want to thank Christophe Morel and Pratim Chatterjee and Mikhail Torrent, also here in the audience. And finally, our sponsors and you for your kind attention. Thank you.
So you are maybe to everybody who is here. This approach is called conceptual density function. I don't see the reason why it can, it is density function. It could be applied more like molecular orbital cell or happy or whatever. I don't see any reason. All the partial derivatives could be computed if they have to compute by electron number. I have discussed in Faraday meeting how to do that. It is one question that is a small remark. You have shown your oscillating picture for pi electron responses. It, at least 30 years ago, I think at the Hübker level, Gutmann in Zagreb had given general proof that pi on the pi electron level, any perturbation is going by oscillatory level. I think it's worth to mention. And the third I would like to ask, you mentioned that there is some problem with taking derivative according to the number of electrons.
Yeah. Maybe coming to your first point, of course I know you can calculate all the quantities with orbitals, but the idea is that the concepts that they are related to the basics of density functional theory, but you can calculate them, of course, the way you want. That's the point. The second point, of course, is related to what I mentioned. In fact, when you go to Huckel theory, and this is not only for this part of chemistry, but many things are already beautifully formulated in Huckel theory, you find them again. But of course, you cannot apply them when you have no unsaturated systems. So it's a nice test, and that's the reason why we came back to Huckel theory, and that it is oscillating is what we expected to see. But of course, if you want to develop something which is much more applicable, you must leave Huckel theory at a certain moment. And finally, the derivatives with respect to N, there has been a lot of discussion now. I think that this way of working has a number of advantages. For example, if you consider very large systems, if then you have to add one electron, for example, or take one electron out with very tiny effects, the idea is that you got very large systems, you can perturb some region of the system, and from that perturbation, in that region, you can obtain responses typical for that region. And that is one of the aims of working with delta V perturbations. But this is not progress.
I have a comment, actually, with all due respect, I'm a little bit puzzled by your statement that the linear response function has not been available before, because within any imaginable level of quantum chemical theory, there are perturbative approaches, starting with CPHF at the Hartree-Fock level, that was derived by late Joe Gerard, and I forgot who was the second person, in 1960s. And in Konshan, you have Kapu Pentel Konshan, and so on. So you can take any quantum mechanical program and get those things immediately.
I agree, but there is a difference between that and getting numbers, which you can easily use.
Well, you can get numbers. You get in an orbital representation that you can contract it within any contraction schemes, Bader, Hirschfeld,
these are
all you can do name it.
I think these are other approaches. I agree.
Your comment?
I'm also referring to comment by Ishpan, because you mentioned this atom Polaris ability. At early 70s, these quantities have been used to characterize the, say, efficiency of different aromatic skeletons to transmit the electronic effect, characterized by the value of Hammett-Rowe constant. And this, of course, was restricted only to these aromatic systems and only applied to pi electron, but your approach now opens the possibility to use it for any system and also include effect of sigma skeleton, so general way to, which really could open the way to quantification of subsequent effects.
I agree. Mm-hmm.
Thanks again to Professor Wagner.